Today, from the Wings Archive, Starhawk answers questions about spirituality and resistance.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
We will never.
Thus spins the magic of Starhawk, witch, writer and poet, teacher and counselor, peace activist, gardener, and a founding member of Reclaiming Collective, an international network of groups and individuals reviving eons-old, goddess-oriented, earth-based spirituality. In April of 97, Starhawk was in Austin, Texas for a week-long, intensive workshop, fondly known as Witch Camp, sponsored by the Tejas Webb of Reclaiming. After camp, she read from her newest novel, Walking to Mercury, at a local bookstore. Wings reporter Frieda Worden recorded the far-ranging question-and-answer session following that reading. Here is a potpourri of powerful ideas from Starhawk, a voice along the path.
Spirituality always holds up different values. It says, you know, there are things that we cannot quantify that are often of greater value than what we can quantify. We can quantify how much profit you make by cutting down an old growth redwood tree, but we have no way of quantifying what that redwood tree means in its own environment and what it's like to walk into an old growth forest and the feelings that you have there and the impact that that has on the soil and on the organisms and on the animals that live there and on the creation of rain further inland and the climate, all of that is more complicated than we have systems for measuring. And so spirituality says we have to value things that go beyond our immediate convenience and that human nature is about more than simply acquiring things. When you have some kind of spiritual base, then your need to continually acquire more and more and more kind of dissipates a little bit. Start to look at things like, well, you know, what does the way I'm living have to do with the rest of the earth? What does it have to do with other human beings? What does it mean for human beings who might have less than I do? I have a responsibility to those people. I have a responsibility to the generations that come after me, and that it's ultimately to my benefit as well as everything else, for me to hold by those values that go beyond my convenience and expediency. What I think we need to be doing now, first of all, is educating ourselves, learning about where is the real power right now, the real economic decisions being made. You know, how do we work, how do we organize in a world where we can influence our governments, but our governments themselves are being bought and sold by interests outside the governments, or where we can pass environmental laws, but the polluters can simply move south of the border, or move to El Salvador, or move to Thailand. That's the question we have to look at, and it's more complex, but I think it is solvable. It's not impossible.
Thank you.
I think what's happening now economically is that we see more and more takeovers and more ways in which corporations and multinationals have gotten outside of the control of any of the governments or any of the institutions where we have some means that would hold them accountable to the communities that they supposedly serve, and where, in fact, it allows them to escape the consequences of a lot of the laws and the things that we do make. I think the gap between the rich and the poor has grown phenomenally and continues to grow. I can even cite statistics. It's something like 1% of the population in the United States controls as much wealth as 85% of the population. In the world, there are something like 343 billionaires today. Back in the 50s, there were something like 15. Those 343 billionaires control as much wealth as the poorest 2.5 billion people. There's a book called When Corporations Rule the World, which is where I got that statistic, by David Corton, which I highly recommend. We're continually being persuaded that the reason that we have less money in our pockets, or that we're working harder for less, or that if you're young you see less of a bright future ahead of you than you might have if you had grown up when I was young, is because of those evil immigrants from across the border, or those welfare mothers, you know, stealing what we should have, when the truth is that, you know, one of those 343 billionaires could probably easily support all the welfare mothers in the country with leftovers.
Shortly after the 1979 publication of Starhawk's The Spiral Dance, Reclaiming Collective grew from a handful of San Francisco Bay Area people who'd read the book on, quote, rituals, invocations, exercises, magic, and wanted to explore that path in community. As popular interest in goddess-oriented spirituality grew, the collective began offering public rituals, and the attendance amazed the original members. There were 1,300 people at a recent public ritual in San Francisco for Halloween, or Samhain, as it's called by some pagans. Currently, the loose-knit organization of groups using Starhawk's teaching for guidance covers the U.S., Canada, England, and Germany. These far-flung groups all share core values of non-hierarchical structure and consensus process of decision-making, values that offer, quote, inclusiveness and empowerment for each person.
One of the things I've been doing recently has been learning a system of ecological design called permaculture, which is a way of growing food and a way of learning to live, applying your intelligence and your ability to observe closely to the earth. And one of the principles in permaculture is that every element in a system should serve more than one purpose. And I think that's also true with political action. You look at it and say, is this going to serve more than one purpose? Some of the direct actions that we did in the 80s, you know, when we blockaded at Diablo Canyon, where they were building a nuclear power plant on an earthquake fault, you know, for me that was a great example. On the one hand, we were trying to influence the media, and we did actually get media attention for that. On the other hand, we were trying to actually physically stop the plant from opening. And we did interfere with the plant for at least about 3 weeks, long enough for an engineer in the plant to make public his discovery that because they had two reactors that were mirror images of each other, they had actually built a lot of them backwards. They mixed up the plans, and it took them another 4 years to straighten all those things out. So it served a number of different purposes, but one of the most powerful things that happened out of that blockade was something that wasn't the original purpose, which was the incredible empowerment it gave to all people who took part in it and the model of organizing it created, because it was the affinity group model where lots of small groups were formed who would make decisions by consensus, who would send spokes to a spokes council, who would then make decisions by consensus. And really, it's the model of organizing now that we keep going back to. So there was an action that I think worked on many, many levels. One of the difficulties we have today when we're doing political action is it is much harder to get media attention than it used to be. In the 60s, it was relatively easy. All you had to do was be entertaining or weird enough and the media would focus on you. Then they got smarter. You know, during the Gulf War, it became really clear that the media was not going to cover any of the resistance to that war. And no matter how much resistance there was, I mean, in San Francisco during the Gulf War, there was practically an uprising. There was activism like that was more than had been ever seen, even in the height of the anti-war stuff in the 60s, because there were thousands of people in the streets every single night for every night that war went on, marching in a way I had never seen before. People didn't even know where we were marching. Nobody knew who was leading the march. Everyone would gather and suddenly it would take off and you'd be marching through the streets, you know, and occasionally we'd look at each other and say, where are we going? I don't know. You know, how did we get here? I don't know. We just have to be here. You know, people blocked the bridges every night. There were two demonstrations on the weekends, a week apart, that had 100,000 people at it, and the New York Times reported 10,000. So that became clear. So I think when we do direct action or we do any kind of action, we have to be looking now at it not as sort of a stage show to influence the media, but saying, what is this doing in and of itself? Is this actually making an impact? And what are the levels it's making an impact on? Sometimes when you're doing political action, you often don't know if you're being effective. You know, when we had all those anti-war demonstrations, there was a tremendous feeling of despair and a feeling that we weren't accomplishing anything. We weren't influencing anything. And because of that, I think people got very, very frustrated and turned to more extreme forms of action. But when you look back on it 10 years later, you can say, oh, well, we did influence things. Someone like Daniel Ellsberg will come forth and say, well, here's something we found now in Nixon's memos, that he was actually going to drop nuclear weapons on Hanoi and Haiphong at one point, at the time of one of those big moratoriums, and they sat around the council and said, well, we can't do that now, there's too many people in the streets. But they never sent out a public announcement saying, hey, you guys, you've won, you've influenced us, we aren't going to bomb high. You know, all of that was very secret.
You're listening to Starhawk, A Voice Along the Path, the words of Starhawk, witch and writer, recorded at a book signing appearance in Austin, Texas, in April 97.
Well, I think the root cause of greed, really, is disconnection. People's lack of connection, lack of integration with the actual earth that we live on, with the place that we live on, with an understanding of the balance of all the systems that we live on. And out of that comes fear and comes a sense of scarcity. It comes this feeling that you can't get enough. There's also aspects of it, I'm sure, have to do with not getting enough nurturing and not getting enough love and not getting enough basic nurturing as infants and all of that kind of stuff. But I think it really goes back to that disconnection, that dislocation of our culture and our society. Because it's like, you know, if you're not getting a balanced diet, if you're not getting enough vitamins, then you're always hungry. And no matter how much you eat, you're never filled up. So I think the cure for it is, as I said earlier, is a shift in our values, is coming to understand what our real relationship is with the earth and how things actually work. And honoring that as what's sacred, as what is most important to us, living with a sense of community and interconnection with other human beings. Earlier today, I was talking about living out in the country. And one of the things up there is, you know, there's a very strong community there. It's a place where sort of that nostalgic vision of America, you know, where your neighbors come and help you out if you need something, and people depend on each other, and you know, people all gather together for the common good. Well, it really works there in a lot of ways. Because of that, you know, I find when I'm up there, I could sit down in the city and read the Smith and Hawk and Garden catalog and lust for my perfect set of ecologically raised teak wood garden furniture, you know. But when I'm out there, it would be like ridiculous because, you know, nobody else has it. Nobody lives like that. It would be kind of outrageous, you know. Nobody has that kind of stuff. Nobody really particularly wants that kind of stuff. I have a very nice set of garden furniture that I recycled from the dump. So you don't feel a great need for that kind of stuff if you have that web of community. What you feel a need for maybe is a big thing to put all the food on when you're eating outside, but it doesn't have to be this certain lovely product that you have to buy at a certain place, and you don't have to get more and more for it. So I think for me that's part of that thing, that sense of really starting to look at relationship rather than at thing. Look at the relationship you have with your food rather than what that thing is called or what that thing cost. You know, look at the relationships that arise out of the stuff you own rather than counting on it and piling it up and putting it in your bank balance. Trusting that human relationships are going to carry you through rather than having to trust your IRA to pull you through at the end. Those are some of the things that can help counter greed. There's a lot of different people having a lot of different visions about environmental disasters and crises and earth changes and whatever. And I think that certainly the way we're going is not a good one environmentally. The likelihood of some kind of environmental crash if we continue living the way we are is high. But see, I live in California. People in California have a vested interest in not believing in apocalyptic earth-changing theories because for some reason they always seem to be dreamed up by people who don't live in California, and the first thing they do is drop California into the ocean. Well, when you live in California, you also know that earthquakes are real and they exist and they will happen and there are bound to be more earthquakes. That's just the way the earth works there. I live, you know, one ridge over from the San Andreas Fault, so I can keep an eye on it. But, you know, you live with it. That's the way it works. You build and take that into account. And you hope you aren't in the wrong place at the wrong time, but if you are, well, at least it's a dramatic way to go. I think the earth also has great qualities of resilience, and that in some ways you have to look at these things and say, what is it doing for us to believe that there's going to be great environmental disastrous earth changes? Is this inspiring us to change the way we live right now, to learn how to be more self-reliant, to learn how to live with the earth, to increase the earth's healing and resilience? Or is it going to inspire us to crawl in a hole and drag it in after us? And if it's inspiring you to live better, then I say it's probably true. And if it's not, then I say don't believe it. At one point when I was meditating in my garden and said, what do you want to be? You know, what should I grow here? And the garden said, grow food. This land wants to feed you because when you eat stuff grown on this land, you become this land, literally, physically. And as I started to grow more of my own food, I found that eating that food was like eating medicine or something. It had a fast healing effect. All kinds of plants potentially are our healers and our friends and our teachers and our allies. But I also think that when you take something that's a very powerful teacher out of context, when you take something you don't have a personal relationship with, you take some chemical version of it that's manufactured in a laboratory, it's like changing your consciousness with a wrench or a tire iron instead of allowing it to open and unfold. Basically, human beings are biologically capable of multiple kinds of consciousness. And really, you know, modern Western culture is the only one that has ever said to people, there is one kind of consciousness and you will stay in it all the time or something is wrong with you, you know. You know, we need a vast range of different kinds of consciousness, and they all serve us in different ways and different purposes. And the problem with using psychedelics in our culture is that they're taken out of their context. There are techniques of meditation, of ritual, of rhythm, all kinds of ways to open up those states of consciousness that are gentler, they're more sophisticated than simply taking a drug. They require a little bit more practice, but they don't necessarily require, you know, an absolute lifetime of practice. I even think about this a lot with herbs, because I do spend a lot of time with herbs and I grow a lot of herbs. It used to be I'd sort of look up the answers in the book and say, oh, I have a stomach ache. It says here mint is good for that. I'll go get my Celestial Seasonings mint tea bag and make myself a cup of mint tea. You know, and that would work to a certain extent. But now what I much prefer to do is to be able to walk out into my garden and say, I'm hurting. Anyone here can help? You know, and look at plants that I actually have a personal relationship with. And when I do, they give something back to me. And it may not always correspond with what the books say. What do I think about prayer in the schools? I think anyone that wants to pray quietly and silently and privately at the moment has an absolute perfect right to do so. But I think having some kind of institutionalized prayer in the schools is just first step to legislating what people are going to believe and how they should believe. And I'm against it. I think the whole thing about separation of church and state has really served us well in having a society that allows a multiplicity of beliefs and allows for voices who believe differently to be heard and have space. And my tactic for defeating it would be to get all the witches and pagans to stand up very strongly in support of it and say, we want to be the first ones to get our day. You know? We'll take Friday. You know? If you're going to have Christian prayer on Monday, you know, or maybe we should take Monday, day of the moon. You know? And we want it skyclad, naked. That's our religious tradition.
Snake woman shedding her skin. Snake woman shedding her skin. Shedding, shedding, shedding her skin. Shedding, shedding, shedding her skin. Snake woman shedding her skin. Snake woman shedding her skin. Shedding, shedding.
For more words from Starhawk, check out these books she's written. The Spiral Dance, A Rebirth of the Ancient Religion of the Great Goddess. Dreaming the Dark, Magic, Sex, and Politics. Truth or Dare, Encounters with Power, Authority, and Mystery. The Fifth Sacred Thing, her first novel. And Walking to Mercury, her second, just released.
Bird woman taking flight, taking, taking, taking flight, taking, taking, taking flight.
Walking to Mercury is my second novel, and one of the questions I often get from people is, why did I turn to writing fiction? And I usually tell them it's simply weakness of character. If you like reading fiction, if you like that sensation of being immersed in a good book, writing fiction is like having that go on for years. The only problem is eventually it stops. The first novel wasn't the first novel I wrote, but the first novel that I actually succeeded in getting published was called The Fifth Sacred Thing, that some of you might know. And that's a novel that's set in the future, in the mid-21st century. In some ways, that's a very different kind of novel than Walking to Mercury, although it is about many of the same characters. The Fifth Sacred Thing, I think of as kind of more of a novel of ideas. It's about two real systems of thought, or two different ways of living. In Northern California, they've achieved kind of the eco-feminist, balanced, multicultural, multiracial, environmentally sound society that I like to think I've been writing about and talking about for years. The only problem is in Southern California, they have a society that has gone in the other direction and that lives out some of the, what I think of as the worst trends in our culture today, towards more control and less diversity, less freedom for people, and less chance for people to live out who they truly are, and much more militarism. And so in that book, you see the South and the North clashing, and you see it played out through the lives of a group of pagans who live in the North, one of whom is a woman named Maya Greenwood, who in that book is 98 years old. And she has been a witch and a writer and a teacher all of her life. And her grandchildren and kind of foster grandchildren who are younger are in some ways the main actors in that book. In this book, this is the story of Maya's early life. She was born in 1950, and so she kind of comes of age in the 60s. And it's much more a book about relationships and about personalities and people. And particularly for me, it's about what it means to try to live out a vision. Because I think a vision is something that tends to be a very slippery animal when you actually try to live with it. It has this tendency to change into something else. In fact, at one point in the book, the young Maya tells her mother, who throughout the book is constantly urging her to go back to school, that she's living for the movement. And her mother says, "You don't understand. A movement is like a mood. You know, it passes and then it's over."
Star woman shining bright,
star woman shining bright, shining, shining, shining bright.
You've been listening to Starhawk, A Voice Along the Path, edited by Elaine Jacobs, Starhawk's words recorded by Frida Worden. A special thank you to Sylvia Adame, an organizer with the Tejas Web, who provided information on Reclaiming Collective. For Women's International News Gathering Service, I'm Elaine Jacobs.
Thanks to all who've supported Wings since 1986, including Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. Recent shows can be downloaded from wingsradio.org. Our sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frida Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.